So I first would like to use the opportunity to thank the Quantum Gravity Group here, and especially Bianca, for inviting me. It's a great honor to be at this nice institute here. And I chose this photograph of the Perimeter Institute because it reminds me of a light cone. Okay. So I'll be talking about this, essentially. It's quantum gravity on a null lattice. Why one would even consider this? So I'll talk about causality, that's the main reason, of course, and the regularization on the null lattice, and maybe a continuum limit. And I'll give the basic construction. It's actually very simple. It harks back to the days of Rege, 61, and it's relatively simple. Dynamics and constraints, I'll discuss especially a consistency condition. Essentially, it's a gluing condition for this lattice. All right, and then I'll talk about it. This lattice theory has an SL2C structure group, and of course you can't use that because it's non-compact. So I'll talk about gauge fixing, essentially, this group. And finally, I would like to end with some global aspects. In other words, this should describe space-time globally, right? I will not make many connections to what has been done already here. You know those much better than I do, and I'm relatively new in this field, very new actually. So I just want to say why I even did this. As you all know, there is no perturbative background in quantum gravity, and 3+1 dimensions are different than 2+1 and 1+1. This point might be mute nowadays, but anyhow, normally at least, Hamiltonian quantum field theory is extremely difficult to handle and to regularize. Nowadays with BF theory, maybe that's possible. Okay, so I thought of defining causal worlds, and that has, of course, been done before by causal dynamical triangulations using rigid simplices, which are slightly different than the original Rege proposal, right? And one has an ambiguity there in maybe the measure, how to count degrees of freedom, what are the symmetries, and the continuum limit. So I thought maybe one can do it also in the original proposal of Rege, essentially, on a deformable but fixed skeleton, which has what I'll call null simplices. So we'll talk about this lattice. As it turns out, I'm now in version 2 of this preprint, and in version 1 there was no mention of GPS. I found out after the construction that the engineers were way ahead of me. Okay, so the idea was very simple, that this is in 2+1 dimensions. You can define an event from three others with spatial separation by simply intersecting their light cones. Okay, and you can do the same thing in four dimensions, of course, and that's the basis of GPS. No, the GPS receiver on this plane receives time-stamped signals from four satellites on known orbits, okay? And now imagine that this so this is the intersection of these four light cones here. It gives you your position and time on this jet. And now imagine, however, that instead of atomic clocks on these satellites, this emission event would have been triggered by another four GPS satellites, and so on, okay? So in other words, you could think of it like this. You could say, you could say that you have to construct a lattice of this type. All right, so such a null, I'll call this a null simplex, which has, in D dimension, it has D null edges and D times D plus one halves, spatial edges, all right? So these spatial lengths here, you can describe it either by its spatial lengths. In 2+1, there are three of them. In 3+1, there are six, all right? Or you could describe it via the light-like vectors here, L tilde. This is a backward null simplex because the tetrahedron, the spatial triangle here is on in the backward light cone of the event. All right. The similar thing, of course, applies for the forward simplex. All right. You can show that there's a unique apex, that there's a new, unique intersection, if the determinant of these spatial lengths squared. Remember, when mu is equal to nu, these are zero. All right. But if the determinant of this 4x4 or 3x3 matrix is less than zero, and then in three dimensions and two dimensions, there is no such constraint. Okay, so in other words, you can't arbitrarily choose these. In three dimensions, you can arbitrarily choose these three lengths. They don't even have to satisfy triangle inequalities. But in four dimensions, you can't. All right, you have to at least satisfy this inequality. But once this inequality is satisfied, you have a unique intersection. So my lattice will look like this. I mean, I can't draw very well, all right? But in 1+1 dimensions, it's essentially the usual diamond, okay? But with light-like, locally light-like geodesics. And in 2+1 dimensions, you have a hypercubic lattice. And the edges of this hypercubic lattice are all zero, or null, right? And you might see that these are spatial hyperplanes here. And in the 2+1 case, they are hexagons. And each alternating triangle is actually illuminated from the previous hyperplane vertex. So these are forward. Null simplexes, in this case, tetrahedra of tetrahedral type, right? And in four dimensions, it's a little bit harder, but not so difficult. Anyhow, it's sufficient to have only the yellow triangles, only the forward triangles, to completely determine the triangulation of the spatial hyperplane. But there are also the blue ones, the backward triangles. They lie on the backward light cones from other events. All right, so they are alternating and intertwined like this. Okay, in four dimensions, it's a little bit, I can't draw it, of course, anymore. All right, but we can say the following. What we have to have is that every event is determined by four others in the past, and it should, of course, determine four others in its future, together with other events, in order to not dilute the lattice, right? So you again need, we are very quickly led to the fact that each node of the lattice must have coordination 8 in this case, and that you are stuck with a hypercubic, at least topologically hypercubic lattice, okay? And the spatial, which I can't tell, but the spatial hyperplanes now consist of tetrahedra, so each event here in the spatial hyperplane is common to four tetrahedra, let's say the forward ones, okay? It's also common to four backward tetrahedra, which are the blue ones here, and you just triangulate the whole three-dimensional hyperplane with these.
So the hypercubic lattice is the only choice, or you can also have?
Well, you have to have one which has coordination 8, all right? Because you need four neighbors in the past to determine your point. And since you don't want to lose any events, you don't want to dilute your lattice exponentially, right?
Then if you want to,
If you wanted to dilute it exponentially, then you can have lesser coordination, okay, all right? But I didn't, okay, so, yeah. And by the way, I mean, I'm drawing everything very regularly here, but you must imagine that all these spatial lengths are, this is deformable, okay, completely. This will only be determined by the fields on this lattice. So here is just showing you that you can, with this tetrahedral octahedral tessellation, you can get the whole of three space. What?
And is there, excuse me, is there a hole in the?
Yes, yes. So these octahedrons are these fit into these holes actually.
Okay.
But each vertex, so it hangs together on vertices. Okay. All right. But it's not space filling. Right? And the reason this have to be tetrahedra is also very clear because they are illuminated. Four events are illuminated, or the four events are on the light cone of a previous point. Right? So, So the four tetrahedra connected to this vertex, you can draw the light cones from each of the four points. And it'll give you a new vertex in the next hyperplane, and the four tetrahedron will give you a whole tetrahedron in the next hyperplane, and so on. Yeah. So this is just a combinatorial problem, but relatively easy to formulate. Another reason: now you would like to know maybe what kind of fields you want on this lattice, all right? And the reason I chose the ones I chose was the following. If you look at first order continuum actions, then something funny happens. So you have your usual Hilbert-Palatini action for gravity, right? First order form, so you can write it as a volume form, not with a curvature, two form here, and this is the cosmological term with four coframe one forms. All right. The ABCDs are not spatial indices. These are the internal indices. Okay, these are one forms, all of them. And and I'll, for convenience, choose that the Planck length is one. All right, that just makes everything dimensionless if you want. But then you can look at Young-Mills, and with some auxiliary fields, you can write down a first order Young-Mills action. Also in curved space-time, again with the one forms of the coframes. All right, and if you shift these auxiliary, these are zero forms, these auxiliary fields. So if you shift them, the traces over the Young-Mills indices of the they carry Young-Mills indices, but space-time-wise they are zero forms. Okay, and if you shift the bead, you get your usual Young-Mills action very nicely with the metric, all right, and a term here which sort of decouples at least from the dynamics of the Young-Mills field, and you might realize that this looks again like a local cosmological term. If you integrate out these auxiliary fields, you're going to get a power of the determinant. That's it. Okay, so you can do the same thing with the scalar, of course. You couple one form, it's all very, very simple, okay? You couple a one form with an auxiliary field to the three form, a field built out of the coframes, all right? And you can do the same with the Weyl spinner, all right? So this is all polynomial in all these fields. And of course, this is equivalent to writing this four volume form, like this, which is more familiar with. Way of coupling a Weyl spinner, right? But you can write it like this also. And the nice thing about this, all these actions are polynomial in the fields. I never have to invert anything or so. Furthermore, these are forms or one forms, and that's suitable for a lattice. You put one forms on links, right? Normally, or something like that. All right. So it's and two forms on surfaces. So we'll not do that quite, but anyhow, that was the original motivation. All right? The lattice variables will not be. Yeah, as I said in these null simplices, actually, you could describe the null simplex completely by the six spatial length, okay, or by the light-like vectors here of its edges. All right. But they will not be actually the variables in the lattice here, but we'll also use the coframe here to make this into a scalar actually, The mu index here is not a vector index. It just indicates which geodesic you're looking at. So we're looking at two events, n and n plus mu, let's say, let's call it, on the lattice, so two nodes, okay? And there's a light-like geodesic between them on some manifold. So what we're actually putting on the lattice is only the tangent of this light-like geodesic using an affine parameterization for the null geodesic with affine parameter going from 0 to 1, all right? So we're replacing this by its tangent at one of the nodes, all right? This has the advantage that it transforms under, Lorentz transformations with the node, and it furthermore is a scalar, right? Because the tangent is a countervariant vector the coframe is a covariant one. All right, and now this the idea that this edge is light-like. So in Minkowski space, of course, there is no deviation. You can call this the discretization error of the lattice, but okay, we'll take that into account. So we'll anyhow have flat simplices. So that's fine. And now the idea that these edges are light-like just means that the determinant of these lat frames, I call them lat frames, although this is not the frame index, really. Okay, it just tells you which geodesic you're looking at. Anyhow, the determinant of these lat frames vanishes from the scalar product here, and that means they are singular and they can be decomposed into spinors. Or in other words, I can with spinors, I can guarantee you that these variables correspond to null separations, okay, of the 2 points. Yeah, so this is the spinor decomposition. This is an old trick, no, of Penrose, I think. I don't know, whoever. All right. Yeah, and then we'll have, since we're doing a first order formulation, we also have SL2C transporters, which parallel transport essentially one of these spinners along the edge, the light-like edge. So I have a few comments on this, which might be controversial, okay? But one could say the following, maybe. All right, these lat frames are not quite in diffeomorphism invariant, but they are invariant on diffeomorphisms that leave the one point where they're defined fixed. Okay, this is a subgroup of the diffeomorphism group, and on a lattice with finite number of points, you could say you still have the diffeomorphism group, which leaves all the lattice points, all the the triangulation points, so to speak, fixed. Okay, that's a subgroup of the diffeomorphisms, and we'll be summing over many such configurations, and the hope is, of course, that the whole diffeomorphism group, which is where these are subgroups of, will be restored in that case. All right? Locally, it's of course not a vector. It's not a vector. It's a scalar. All right? These coframes, these lat frames, and the real question is that if there are actually two such configurations which describe exactly the same manifold, possible. Okay. In fact, we'll see that it's possible. Simple Minkowski space allows for many such null triangulations. However, we'll see that they are all determined by the boundaries. Okay. So in this sense, this is a global issue which I'll discuss a little later. All right. What was important in this construction was that we have local Lorentz symmetry. You might see that these lat frames actually are the displacements in a local inertial system, which is where the coframes are just unity at that point, at n, Okay. So at that, for local inertial system, which where the coframe is unity at a particular point, the lat frame is actually the displacement vector to the neighboring event. And since all these inertial systems are supposed to be equivalent, we will have to have that the model is invariant under SL, under Lorentz transformations of this index. Right? Actually, we're going to use SL2C because we want to have spinners. All right, and so the lat frames will transform as shown here, right, the usual way. And we demand SLTC invariants of the whole lattice. So let's look at what are the possible SL2C invariants. Sorry, I wrote SLC. It should be SL2C, but anyhow. So the spinners transform like this, and the transporters, of course, transform with SL2C matrices at different points, at the endpoints. Okay, and now you can ask what SL2C invariants can you form. Well, there's an obvious one. You would think you take some U's and make a monotomy. And that's it, right? You need, however, the u to the minus ones here, also the inverses. And we can eliminate these closed Wilson loops, which is something you normally wouldn't do, okay? But I'll tell you why I think it's not such a bad idea, okay? You can eliminate these closed Wilson loops of u's if you say that traversing a link in the opposite direction of the orientation of the link on the lattice, you don't get the inverse. You get only its Hermitian conjugate. Okay? That doesn't allow you to make any closed Wilson loops on the lattice anymore, because you have to go, some links have to be traversed opposite to their orientation, right? To make a loop. And then you're left only with these invariants. The only invariants you can form are actually used in one direction, so to speak, and bookended by the spinners. This is the charge conjugate spinner where you use your epsilons to move it down. All right? But anyhow, so this is a contiguous string of transport matrices and ended by the spinners. These are the basic SL2C invariants on this lattice.
What you're saying here is that all future-oriented links carry an unprimed representation of SL2C, and
yes.
past
always prime.
Carry a
right.
prime.
Right.
And therefore, you can form no closed loops because you cannot.
Yeah, you can't. You wouldn't have the SL2C invariants. Okay, all right. Exactly. So let's look at some of these invariants. These are not yet the observables on the lattice. Yeah?
Can you go back or just review, what are the basic variables that are, you haven't written down an action yet, I guess, but I.
No, I haven't. I'm going to derive the action from only symmetry concentrations.
But what are the dynamical variables that are going to enter into the action?
Only these spinners, these two guys.
So can you just say what it is at each vertex?
Okay. Yeah, well, we can see that from the invariants here, right? This is the SL2C invariant. So at each node of the lattice, you'll have four spinners.
At each node, we'll have four spinners.
Spinners, okay.
Four about
xi's, and also four xi bars, if you like, all right?
Yes.
And at each link, you'll have transport matrix, and in the opposite direction, you'll have the Hermitian conjugate transport matrix.
So each link will have an element of SL2C.
SL2C element, which is this transport.
Will have,
what?
In each node, we'll have eight spinners.
We'll have eight spinners, yes. Four of them transforming with G, and four with a Hermitian conjugate group, right? Don't worry, it comes out right.
No, I'm not worried. My only worry is where these spinners are living. Are they living?
They're living on site.
Are they all living? No, but in what space are they living? Are they all in the same spinner space, which is some sort of ghostly spinner space, or are they attached? There's no There's no
this index here doesn't well it gives you an index of a associated geodesic, if you like.
But I mean, there's no tangent space in this situation, is
there? The tangent space was here. It is this guy. Wait. Tangent space was here. Yeah, this guy. This way. So I'm going to actually. I will always form these lat frames here out of the spinners. Okay. The tangent space is this, right? I mean, the tangent along a geodesic, along a null geodesic from site n to site n plus mu.
But there's no background space. You're not doing this in Minkowski space, are you? Or in any fixed manifold? How do you know where the geodesic goes?
Well, I'll tell you that you never need. Okay, you're right. You'll never need these tangents themselves. The reason being this one, okay, actually, even for meta actions. So you don't need, you only need the combination. The reason is because you can write all these meta actions without reference actually to the meta, I mean only in terms of the coframes. So what happens is that you only need the one forms, right? You only need the coframes.
I could ask the same question about one form, but maybe just to understand, so just to think about concretely, if you had to represent one of these lat frames or whatever, one of these configurations.
Yes.
Would I just give eight column vectors of height 2 with complex entries, and for each node, and
yeah, you give me a
for each link, I would just give some element of SL2C.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Okay, for the moment, at least. Yeah. Okay. So, we'll have constraints on those, but what you are allowed to do. But otherwise, it will be that. Yeah. Okay. So I want to list the first few. There are three here only. All right. And they're constructed like this. Okay. The first one doesn't have any any transport matrix in between, and this is an antisymmetric tensor, if you like, in the indices. No, it's not a tensor. Antisymmetric matrix in mu and nu. All right. And it's of course an SL2C invariant. And it's complex, all right? Then there's another one which has three indices here, but I won't be able to use this one. And so I don't really understand. Well, it's just a transport of one spinner to the other side. But what will be of interest is this chi, which has two of these transport matrices. And if the indices are different, then they go around the corner, right? So on the lattice, and bookended by these spinners again. I'll show a few pictures also that it becomes a little bit clearer in a second. Now, the point is that the lattice observables have an additional symmetry, namely a U1 for each of the four spinners. Okay, so the spinners they transform by a U1 with some arbitrary angle here, all right. And these U1s will guarantee, since they're local also, they will guarantee that the spinners have to combine to these lat frames actually, all right. So we are essentially enforcing this symmetry. Will give us observables, and they will be real or purely imaginary, one of the two things actually, and so on. So some observables, for instance, are, which you can build out of the previous invariants. No, now you just have to watch that you also have this U1 to the fourth symmetry, and one is the absolute values of this F mu mu, or of this antisymmetric matrix, or F mu times F mu star, built from the barred spinners, and that's of course nothing else but the length of your null simplex, right, with the node. So the null simplex has a special node, which is the one from which the four light-like light-like distances come out, and that that particular node then defines you those four those lengths, right? And of course, L mu mu is zero with mu equal to mu. So not only not summed. Okay, this is just equal indices is automatically zero because each of these f's is zero, and they're all automatically space-like. I'm using a metric where almost everything is positive. All right, so they're automatically space-like because this is square.
What was f mu nu again?
What? F mu mu was just this contraction of the of a spinner with a, with itself with another spinner at the same site. F mu mu was this guy. It's just a SL2C invariant you can build out of two spinners with mu and in with index mu and mu. All right, and you square that thing, and you can rewrite it in terms of the lat frames, and you can rewrite in terms of the displacements and the metric, and you get nothing else but but the six lengths of your six invariant lengths of your.
So let me understand. So you have like you have this these four null vectors,
right?
And at the base, let's say you have these spinners corresponding.
Right.
You intersect. I mean, you take their inner products.
Right.
And that's giving you the lengths of the region that's
well,
living,
the square of it, yeah.
That's living at the neighboring place.
At the two, at the, so each scale of, each product gives you the length of the, well, of the space-like distance between the two rays, the corresponding two rays.
Space-like, yeah, but it's a distance at a different place. It's a distance of a, well,
yeah, in the frame, however, of the, of n. It is in the, it's a distance. Oh, you would have it in Minkowski, yeah,
it's
a Minkowski space. So the null simplex will
be flat.
Yeah, it will be flat. Okay, yeah, yeah. You, it's a distance you would have in Minkowski space at n. All right. So in the each, yeah, each simplex is flat essentially. Okay. On this lattice. So, the interesting thing here is you can build another one out of these f's. Yeah, another observable by just cyclically going through all four of these f's, and that is turns out to be nothing else but the determinant of your lat frame, but written not now in spinner indices. It's just the volume. Okay, it's the volume for form actually, and of this simplex. It gives you the volume of the simplex at the point n. And then, as I said, the one with three indices I can't use. Okay, I don't get anything useful out of this. Because we'll be interested in quantities which are related to four forms on the lattice, and we'll be interested in antisymmetric observables for the action, antisymmetric observables in all four indices here. All right, there are, other, there are two more. Bear with me. I call this P, and that's just this this invariant I had before with two U's. Where do I have it? Here. Okay. Now this is this invariant here, and you can make it into an observable by contracting correctly with its complex conjugate. So, sorry. This is this one. Okay, so you can contract them like this with sigma and rho interchange. You have to keep the same u in order to make a lat frame. These are the spinner indices here. So you have to keep the same mu and the same nu, but otherwise you can exchange the two the two indices of the transporters here. And so the expression for this is this, okay? And on the lattice, and there is a second one where you don't exchange them, where you simply, where the one where you don't exchange these two, where you simply take the absolute value of this guy, and that just looks essentially the same, except that you will see that, that well, okay. let me show it to you graphically. So what we have built here, the simplest observables we have built with four indices, was the volume. So you have a spinner here and the complex conjugate spinner, and so on. You go around the point n in all four directions, and you get the volume of your simplex. The second one was this p, and that's you transport the, so this spinner has some index mu, and you transport it around this curve with a bookended spinner, and then you have the inverse. You go around the other curve. In other words, first rho, then sigma, then rho and sigma also in the backward direction. All right, this is this p. And finally, we have this q, which was just the changing. So you go back in sigma and back in rho instead of around the other side here. And it looks like this. It doesn't close any bracket. All right. You can ask for parity and time inverse invariance of these quantities. So these are both even here, the first two. The third one is odd. And if you make a low curvature expansion of the transport matrices, you can identify this lattice object with the Hilbert-Palatini action, and this lattice object with the Barberio-Mizzi or host action. Not the whole host. Just the topological terms, right? Yeah, it probably also contains an oil, but then as a lattice artifact, it probably also has a contribution to the Euler, simply from symmetries and so on, to the Euler number in the continuum limit. Right? But this is just from a naive expansion for low curvatures, for the SL2C transport is close to one. All right? So if you want a PT symmetric action, an even action, you have essentially only these two terms to play with. It's totally anti-symmetric. And this term, by the way, it's also quite interesting. Both of them are purely imaginary automatically. All right? So your action of the lattice, or I times S, I should have written, is of this form with an arbitrary parameter that is four times your cosmological constant. It's fine. All right? You can, of course, add this here with a complex conjugate, with a purely complex coefficient. And then you can try all the tricks. What?
The action in general is complex?
No. This thing is real. I mean, well, it's purely complex, OK? It has an I. I should have written it times I, OK? But that's it. OK, both the volume and this Hilbert-Palatini term come out real. Okay, and not just in lowest, not just as a expansion. Okay, this is you can just complex conjugate it and see that you're getting the same thing. Okay, up to minus sign. So that is the I.
Can you say what this?
Yes.
The first one you gave a geometric interpretation. It's just the I guess it's the volume of the four simplex or the volume of the three.
Of the four simplex.
It's the volume of the four simplex.
Volume of the four simplex.
Okay, so
it's a four volume.
Right. And then the
second one, I can tell you that it includes the curvature, right? It goes around one of the plaquettes.
But you said the simplexes are flat. The four simplexes are flat.
Yeah.
So there should be some interpretation in terms of the geometry of that four simplex. Of what this.
Well, this is not, these are not all, these lengths don't all belong to the same four simplex anymore. What?
Some are going to a neighboring force.
So simplex, right? And you're running. It's essentially the same thing as you do in reggae. You go around a particular vertex here. But yes, I agree. It should be examined to see that this is actually the deficit angle of these of the simplices.
But that's what you think it is?
Well, at least for weak coupling or for weak. Yeah, for weak curvature, I get directly the Hilbert-Palatini action back. So what should it be?
Okay.
also here the connection is independent from the spinners, so it's a first order action.
Yeah, right.
So it's at the level of the action, it's not yet clear whether there is a deficit angle.
Whether there is, yeah.
Because it's
we couldn't say that really.
But okay, but if you put yourself into edge A, then the curvature is around Heindels.
Sorry.
In edge A, the curvature in 4D is around Heindels, and so
yeah.
You have one variable P n, which is associated to one vertex, whereas kind of a deficit angle. Some contraction. It looks like one deficit angle, but it should be something like rather a contraction of deficit angles.
Well,
so the question is also if it's including.
Well, you sum here over. Well, okay.
Like areas
yeah.
at
okay, I didn't like examine it.
Like
I didn't beyond. Beyond the low simple expansion, I mean, in terms of low curvature, I did not examine this term. Okay, I must say. All right.
I think maybe more general question is whether the question is you have an argument that you capture all curvature or only the curvature maybe around the null triangles of your triangle.
I saw whether it's only spatial or something like that.
Or is it only spatial? Or?
No, not really. Okay.
So there would be, you have at least.
Well, the diagonal is spatial.
Or is it different from Regge because here the loop is not going around the triangle, it follows itself the. So
yeah.
It's only one lattice. They're not two lattice.
It's not. Okay, but yeah, I must pass here
no,
early.
That's
more.
Because here
we use
along.
It's not.
Okay.
I will not get a Hamilton.
So,
but there are still some consistency conditions in addition to the action. Actually, to make this lattice work, okay, and
the left side, is that loop, that parallelogram in the middle, is that within one simplex or is it involving neighboring simplexes?
It involves. Well, here you are already at a neighboring simplex, right? Yeah, it's not. No, it's not on one only.
I see.
Yeah, it's.
One thing that came up before, but I wasn't sure. If you take all your four simplicities, they don't fill up.
They don't
space
fill
time,
up.
Is that right?
No. Okay, we'll see in a second. I mean, they alternate with the other guys. Yeah, they don't fill up the whole space.
And you don't use the other simplex, the other.
No.
Okay.
Okay. So it's a rather loose mesh, if you like. Yeah. It's like.
It's not really like special case of Regge calculus.
No, Regge would be doing. Would triangulate completely.
You don't have a triangulation of.
I do have a triangulation.
No, you don't. Not in the
technically. Then it's not if you have holes.
If I have holes, I don't have what?
Triangulation.
Yeah, well, okay, yeah, you would have to draw one line across such a hole. But I mean, that's all.
But you haven't associated a geometry to that hole. That's sort of what I'm asking.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, so that's, yeah, well, maybe not. Okay, I'm sorry to that.
It doesn't say you have to do it, I'm just... trying to understand what.
Yeah, it's just the idea. Well, I think I can do the. So with this triangulation, you should be able to uniquely define your points. Okay, I mean that's what you should be able to do, and I think you need to do that. Actually, you have a consistency. I call it consistency condition on this You can't have any six lengths, and you it's very simple. You can't have any six lengths here, well, they are given anyhow by light-like vectors, so these least lengths always satisfy them. The condition that the determinant of these length squares is less than zero, okay? And here you have a simple, so this is the forward simplex, and we are only going to actually use these rays, only forward rays, but in principle, of course, you have the backward, this whole, okay, this is the yellow tetrahedrons I showed you, and these are the blue tetrahedra, essentially spatial tetrahedra. All these lengths are spatial, all right? They are illuminated by another vertex on this lattice, and therefore also should be satisfying the condition that the determinant of these L's is less than zero. In fact, these lengths will be defined once you have these. It's just the usual Rege triangle inequalities, if you like. They become rather simple here because most of them are not disappear. Most of them are null lengths anyway, so you don't have to worry about them. But you have to worry about your spatial lengths, that they actually fit together. All right. Or looking at it this way, you can go on your lattice first in mu and new direction. Here you have the forward light-like separations. It's exactly 1, 2 here. All right. And then from this point of view on the lattice, from this node, the same length must be described, of course, as this one. But notice that this length is actually this length at a different point, right? So in order to actually be able to glue this lattice together, these lengths have to coincide. So you must have that this L mu mu tilde squared must be equal to the L mu mu squared at the other point. And these tildes have to lie on the light cone. So in other words, once I have these lengths given by the forward part, simplexes, null simplexes, then there must be a node of the lattice which illuminates them, or in other words, that node must be uniquely defined. And to do that, these lengths have to satisfy the condition that, wait, I don't have the condition here. Okay. Well, the condition comes on the next slide. But the condition that the determinant of their squares must be greater than zero. All right? So the point is, I'm never going to use these light-like edges of the backward simplexes, simply because that would be overcounting, right? But they must sort of exist. I mean, they must have light-like distances between these nodes here. And for that to be true, you get a consistency condition of the lengths on different simplices. So there are several ways of getting, they are all equivalent, these consistency conditions. So either you say that the lat frames, scalar product of the lat frames, which is this length, okay, because they are null themselves, are equal to the scalar products of the backward null frames, and they must exist, okay, these backward null frames, you should be able to construct them. A more interesting one is that you can also write this this condition that you can make a light cone, you can write as the Pfaffian of this matrix F. Must be vanishing, and so now in order to have this that these points are illuminated from the backward light cone, you have to have the Pfaffian of this antisymmetric matrix vanishing, not only of F of n, but of this one here as well, right? And you see here you're composing it with neighboring points, right? That's the same thing. You can also write it in terms of triangle inequalities, in terms of these lengths here. It's algebraically the same as this condition here. So here you have to choose spinner phases that is true. All right, and if these lengths satisfy triangle inequalities, then you can glue your lattice together, okay? And, or you can also write it like this. This determinant here must be less than zero, and this determinant is nothing else but these lengths here to the fourth power and so on. It's a quadratic form in these lengths squared, okay? Which are the original lengths at different points. All right, and that's the last one you can interpret as the following. You're giving six lengths from the forward simplices, from six different forward simplices, you get these six lengths. And now they should be all illuminated from a backward vertex. And so the volume of that backward simplex should be real, or the square of it should be negative. Okay, the volume is actually minus this determinant. So this is the only condition I found which might prevent, or which prevents you normally from gluing this lattice into a manifold. Right? There's only one left. Okay, so because instead of all, you can think of it in triangle inequalities, and there are only three instead of 10 or so in the rigid calculus, with normal tetrahedra.
Yeah, actually, there are usually more in rigid calculus.
What?
There are more than just the triangle inequalities, because there's a generalized triangle inequality.
I just didn't hear acoustical.
There are also generalized triangle inequalities. So actually, I'm a bit surprised here that this condition that we have these triangle inequalities and that the fold volume is real is equivalent. Because in Ricci calculus, you have the triangle inequalities and the generalized triangle inequalities.
Yes, but it simplifies a lot if you have.
They don't apply each other. That's equivalent.
Yeah, but you try some of them as being null, some of these lengths as being null.
So
then you'll get a lot of them eliminated.
So that's why 3 and 4 are equivalent?
Sorry?
Are you saying that 3 and 4 are equivalent?
Yes, 3 and 4 are completely equivalent. You just calculate. These three triangle inequalities you can put together and show that. If they are satisfied, this is greater than zero. If they are not satisfied, this is less than zero. Okay, so it's just a matter of, it's algebra. Okay, a bit lengthy, but not terrible. And so these triangle inequalities are actually all subsumed in here. They are, of course, it's a much higher polynomial, that's all. All right? But actually, it's easier to implement the triangle inequalities than here. And that these triangle inequalities are equivalent to this is also clear, because if you write the Pfaffian out, you get the sum of three complex numbers. And the sum of these three complex numbers should be zero. So that's only possible if the magnitudes of these complex numbers, which are exactly A, B, and C, are satisfied triangle inequalities, right? And once they do, you can find the spinor phases so that they are actually zero.
What about the three simplex itself, the tetrahedron? Those lengths can't be chosen arbitrarily. There must be one constraint of the sort that Bianca is talking about.
Well, they are not spatial. They are spatial tetrahedra, but this is you can build a triangle with three lengths, spatial Minkowski lengths, which don't satisfy triangle inequalities. You can still make a triangle out of them, right?
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
you can have three lengths that don't satisfy the triangle
inequalities in Minkowski space, and still from 3 points. You can have 3 points.
Not if they're spatially. Not if they're all on a space.
No, they're equal. Not if you can put them all on a spatial plane. But you can't usually put three Minkowski events on a spatial plane. Even if they have, you can only put two in any.
So some of these tetrahedra will not be space-like. Is that right?
No, all the edges are space-like.
Yeah, but the tetrahedron itself will not be space-like. In the same way that you're saying a triangle could be not
space-like. Not space-like, yeah, in this sense, yeah. Yeah, so then you don't slice these hyperplanes as you can't identify them with the time equal to constant planes. You're not even four events on them, actually, locally. It doesn't work that way. It's peculiar, but you can think of it like this. You have a light cone, backwards or forward, doesn't matter, and you choose three events on that light cone which are simultaneous, and choose a fourth one which is not. No Lorentz transformation will make all four of them simultaneous, no way. In fact, you can do it already with three, you can't do it, all right?
Let's think of the TZ plane, for instance, and you put.
Then
the triangle inequalities are violated.
Yes, correct. Yeah, so that's what's going on. I understand that's what's going on here too, but.
Is that so bad? I have no Hamiltonian formalism, so I can't do it so easily. Okay? I'm talking much too long, right? What do we have already? Okay. Yeah, and I claim, okay, without proof here, but I claim that the reconstruction of the whole causal manifold from a given set of lat frames is unique, or from a given set of spinners, if you like, null lat frames, okay? I should have written null here. Okay, from a given set of spinners is unique if any one of these conditions is satisfied, all right? And as far as two is concerned, you can see if you have a Pfaffian equal to zero, you can find the spinners so that this anti-symmetric matrix is given by the spinners, all right? And therefore you have light-like rays, etc. Okay, these are just algebraical things essentially. So, another thing which might be of interest for lattice theory of this type is its integration measure. Okay, and I claim one can almost uniquely, we'll make use of this almost actually. You can almost uniquely determine it from its group structure of this lattice. All right. There's essentially you have only the Haar measure for the SL2C Haar measure for the U's or for the transport matrices, which is that in some radial coordinates here, all right, and for this each spinner, you also have you can use a radial parametrization. A spherical parametrization for the spinner of this type, and you have essentially because only this measure, you can get it from the fact that the lat frames have to be null. All right. So these measures are sort of fixed. However, when you calculate the whole lattice measure, even if you only want a local one, okay, I presume that we want only a local lattice measure. So our lattice theory should look like this, right? So the action we have approximately, I mean, we have it, it's the Palatini, and the lattice measure. So we have the measure for the spinners, and we have the measure for the transport. Portus here, which is the Haar measure, all right? But then you have, in principle, any weight, any local weight, which is SL2C invariant, right? And this density just has to be real and positive and should be, hopefully, on the lattice at least isotropic, meaning it shouldn't distinguish any of these directions, okay? And you come to the conclusion that it probably is only since the only invariant, which is SL2C and local, is this F, this matrix F, you come to the conclusion that this rho should only depend on the local volume, should be some function of the local volume. And then you say, well, if I only want to describe this lattice at the continuum limit of the lattice, or at least small local four volumes of each of these simplexes, then I can assume that this density should go with the local volume to some power, which we don't know, which is gamma. This is our lattice cutoff. Okay? This gamma here will be the lattice cutoff. Because up to now, we have just triangulated, right? You can make that triangulation as small as you want, okay? As fine as you want. There's no way to prevent that, okay? And if we did introduce some size, we would lose the SL2C invariance completely, right? So we don't want to do that. We will instead write this density here will be some power of the four volume at each lattice site. And you can imagine if this gamma is sufficiently large, you are suppressing lattice configuration with small four volumes, right? And you're increasing the probability for a lattice configuration with large four volumes in each simplex, all right? The cosmological term up there does essentially the opposite. It doesn't like too much of a volume, right? I mean, at least if you're in Euclidean space, or otherwise it would be oscillating a lot. So essentially, this row here provides pressure for this lattice, volumes to not shrink too much, okay? And in fact, there's a critical value for this gamma where the lattice will collapse. It will just disappear on you, okay? All right. So, and I'll show you this in numerical simulations.
So that is with a complex action? I mean, is it a complex experiment?
Yeah, this is still complex. Yeah. That's another issue. Okay. Yeah. But now, first of all, we have a few more issues to deal with. This is still very badly defined. Okay. Because all our observables are SL2C invariant, right? And this is a non-compact group, and the measure is by construction so far, the measure is SL2C invariant, and so forth. So you get immediately that this partition function, forget about the I here, explodes on you. I mean, it's arbitrary, it's infinity. And of course, you say, all right, well, if I want to have expectation values, I always divide by some observables, which are SL2C invariant. Formally, this volume of the SL2C group should drop out. Well, you can make this a little bit better by simply fixing, gauge fixing, if you like, the SL2C group. So it's the same idea as, I mean, okay, most of you probably have done this 50 times, but anyhow, it's the same idea as if you have only radially symmetric observables and you want to take expectation values of them in some theory here, some simple one, then you can remove the volume of them, of S2 here in this case, right? So you can essentially, yeah, and this drops out. So the only difference is that we have to cancel an infinite volume, right? So we want to remove an infinite volume, that of the SL2C group, okay? And this is done by gauge fixing or by localizing the SL2C. In this case, it's pretty simple actually, because we have local variables. We don't have to use the SL2C transport matrices. We can use our spinners, okay? And you can do this. Correctly, all right. You define some sort of Moser function, if you like. Maybe this is overkill, but first of all, you define a Moser function which is SU2 invariant. Okay, so if G is out of SU2, these are just the SLC transformed spinners, right? Here and here. So if G is out of SU2, the subgroup of SL2C, then this doesn't depend on G, right? And so you only have, it's an SU2 invariant Moser function. It's also always positive by definition. The weights are arbitrary, they just have to be larger than zero, okay, at each site, and that can be used to make certain paths easy. All right, anyhow. What it means really is that the weighted sum of the time components of your lat frames is always greater than zero because they're forward point in time. And now you can minimize this with respect to SL2C variation, and you get a very simple gauge condition, which simply says that you awaited some of your spatial components of the lat frames vanishes. And you can show that this condition has only one solution, no matter what W's you use, because the Hessian of your Moser function is actually, again, it's a second variation of this thing with respect to SL2C. It returns you the Moser function itself, okay, or it's proportional to the Moser function itself with a unit, unit matrix, which is 3x3. All right, so this is always positive, and therefore, if there is any minimum, there is only one. Okay, and in particular, what I found useful, so there's a unique solution normally for this. It's certainly not two; it's either none or one. All right, and you can then divide out you can reduce or you can localize the SL2C to SU2 structure group this way, and the SU2 structure group has finite volume, right? So as an example, the example actually is what we used. Okay, you choose two lat frames, you choose two of these W's equal to each other, and the other one all zero, then you immediately see that this gauge condition is that the two time-like components, the two spatial components of the corresponding lat frame are opposite and equal. Obviously, they're also simultaneous then because they are zero. They are null vectors, all right? And that, so you can always get into that frame here. And in actual fact, this has a physical meaning. It means you can always choose an inertial system where this occurs. Okay, at each site of that lattice, you could choose a particular inertial system where you have where the two of these lat frames have equal spatial components. Okay, and that's simultaneous. You have to stop.
5 minutes, maybe, because
5 minutes. Okay. Yeah, I should be finished. I will not go into this anymore. Okay. Yeah. You can do it further. You can reduce the SU22. The nice thing about this is the only reason I'm showing you this is that you can write down a completely localized integration measure. It doesn't have any SL2C anymore, all right? And it in these radial coordinates, it's given by this, all right? You might complain, but wait, hold on. And with this completely localized measure, we can also guarantee that the volume at each simplex is always positive, okay? Yeah, because it depends after this gauge fixing only on the sine of phi. These are in the always positive, and by restricting simply the integral over phi from 0 to pi instead of 2 pi, you will get only an oriented, you have not only an oriented lattice, but the simplexes are also oriented, or all the volumes are positive. And the cool thing about this is that you can, so after this total gauge fixing, you can actually rewrite your measure in terms of the invariant lengths. And you get back essentially the Regge measure, where the exponent here for the volume is your regulator. Okay, so the ambiguity in the Regge measure is here used as a way of regulating the theory. All right? And, yeah, except for these two spinner things, but they are irrelevant if you. So, if you write every, if you look. So, what I can do here was to write the generating function for, in the what I call the strong coupling or naive strong coupling limit, meaning you only retain the cosmological term, you forget about curvature, all right? And in that case, you can write everything in terms of now again the spatial lengths of these simplices, of these null simplices. There are only six of them, all right? But you have the volume. You can write in terms of this determinant of these spatial lengths, and even the consistency condition you can write into. It is a theta function of the corresponding. L tildes. Okay, so you can write everything in terms of these spatial lengths here in this case, right? And the L tildes are, okay, given by the usual thing. So the L tildes are just the shifted L. All right, and what is nice? Yeah, now I'll tell you that that some of these lattice, these null triangulations are not unique, and we can see that already in 1+1 dimensions, right? So here's, let's say, flat Minkowski 1+1 space, all right? And you have your light cone here, and this is a typical null triangulation of that light cone in that case, all right? And this is also one, all right? The same space. I just move, but what happened here is that I moved these nodes on the side. The internal, I don't have any choice here, okay, as long as it's flat space, all right, which I'm trying to describe. Okay, but there are these symmetries which allow me to actually move these nodes, okay? These are residual symmetries which turned out, you have to read the paper, but they actually exist, okay? There, I can move these nodes, and you can, and here you can compactify this, or not, you can identify this ray and this ray, and you can get an ice cream cone out of it, all right? With essentially an S1, a spatial S1, and if you like, you can call the bottom guy the Big Bang, okay? And otherwise, you have locally null lattice. So, and I just want to show you I'll finish here. The numerical results in 3+1 dimensions, this identification is a little bit much more complicated, okay, but it can be done. And so we can calculate slices of the volume for each of the for each of our hyperplanes. Okay, so I simulated this lattice with, of course, purely imaginary cohomological constant, because then I get real results, right? Which means this is not physical. This is you would have to continue it back in lambda. But anyhow, it converges very nicely once you put the consistency conditions in, right? And this is the total volume of the lattice. It only has seven. The level is only up to 7 depths. Anyhow, but the nice thing about it is also when you vary this, when you vary the cutoff gamma, the volume of the lattice changes, of course, because it's ultraviolet cutoff, and even for fixed beta here, and you see that it collapses at gamma equal to -2, which is the conformal point of this measure. Right. And that's everything. Thank you very much for your patience. And so I turn this around.